From the studios of Boise State Public Radio News, I'm Gemma Cadet. You're listening to Idaho Matters. Just after Christmas last year, police in Pennsylvania arrested Brian Koberger and charged him with the killings of four University of Idaho students. Now, if you remember, that case sparked shock and fear in students and parents alike, and Idaho became the focus of an intense media as well as social media spotlight, which at times turned sordid and it turned ugly. Author J. Reuben Appleman wanted to look closer at the case, the four victims, as well as society's increasing fascination with true crime. His new book, While Idaho Slept, The Hunt for Answers in the Murders of Four College Students, is out right now. And we wanted to bring Jay back on Idaho Matters to talk about this. So he's joining us live today. Hi, Jay.
Hey, Gemma.
So, Jay, we had you on the show all the way back in 2018 to talk about your book, The Kill Jar. This was about a Detroit serial killer. I'm curious about why you decided to write about the University of Idaho murder case in particular when it's still going on.
Yeah, it's a really great question. I wrote about the kill jar because the topic of it, because the topic, the Oakland County child killings, occurred in what was then virtually my backyard in the 1970s. Four kids had been abducted and killed right around the neighborhoods surrounding my house. And it mattered to me. I've never been a true crime buff, to be honest. I don't read true crime books. I don't watch true crime documentaries. But the case mattered to me. And so I wrote about it. And then that happened again here in Idaho, again, four children, basically a different age of children. But these were, they were so young, in their early 20s. Mm-hmm. And in what I consider my virtual backyard. I mean, as you know, being here in Idaho, Moscow is quite a distance, 5 hours away from Boise, but the state of Idaho is a very tight-knit state with many tentacles reaching between our communities in Boise in the south and in North Idaho. Many people that we probably both know have children who were going to the University of Idaho at the time. My own daughter went to the University of Idaho, it's a case that didn't just touch me because of its incredible gore and terror factor. I mean, that's not why I would have written this book. I'm not interested in those things. I'm interested in how communities recover after the visitation of violence, and this felt like a part of my community.
Mm-hmm. I think you bring such a good point up, and this is what I told so many people after this horrible incident happened, is that, Idaho is small. We're a small state. So somebody, like everyone is connected to someone at the University of Idaho, right? And so I think it felt very personal for so many people. And I think when you say that, right, that it's in our own backyard, it is, because we have, we have good friends that live in Moscow. I went to school at Washington State. My husband went to law school at University of Idaho. I mean, we have good friends who lived in that house while my husband was in law school. My husband lived around the corner from that house, right? So there's all of these tentacles, as you said, that we all feel so personally, tragically connected to this. So with that said, when you heard about this case, where were you? What were you doing? I mean, because I remember, and I couldn't wrap my head around it. Like, it took me a while to wrap my head around what actually happened.
Yeah. I was just in my home, getting blips from text messages. Hey, did you hear what happened up there? Whatever. I finally looked at the news, and very quickly I was overcome by a sense of having to be there. It's the same thing that I felt, although I didn't act on it, when Michael Vaughn, little what they call Monkey, the little boy who was abducted from Fruitland in Idaho, and I felt the same thing. I felt like this horrible thing has happened. I have to go there somehow, and that is a protective instinct in me that has been with me since I was a child. Many people would say it was probably from watching small versions of domestic violence occur in my home, and and having the feeling of like needing to protect my mother or something like that. But I do believe it's rooted deeply in me. And that's how I felt about this case. I felt obviously there was nobody to protect, but I just felt compelled to go up there. And that's what I did. I went up to Moscow and I got a motel room and I started talking to people and I started feeling things. And I don't really know what I was doing there. I wasn't initially intent on writing a book. In fact, I was trying to talk myself out of it. But I had a good friend who talked me into it, basically. And one thing about the tentacles that you mentioned, and like, for instance, you knowing people who lived in the house and such, writing the book was actually a sort of risky. It felt risky to me because of the community that I'm attached to. I know that some people look at it like somebody who's maybe exploiting a series of crimes, but I did not approach it like that. I knew that would be the vibe, though, of some people, you know, and I felt that was a risky thing because I live here. But what I really felt like I was doing was telling the story that needed to be told. The breaking news reporters will give you some version of things, and that's the story, sure, on the surface. But what books do is they add richness and context, and they allow you space to breathe through what happened and to figure out how you feel about certain things. And that's what I wanted to do, offer some sort of material for the people who knew about this case or who maybe didn't, but mostly people know about this case, but offer some material that allows them to process what they've just been bombarded with in the nightly news for 10 months. And I didn't know that's what I was doing up there. I went up there and I just started feeling things and it ended up becoming this book, you know?
So I know in the book you focus quite a bit on how really the town of Moscow was just flooded with national media, with social media personalities, you know, as the search for a suspect went on. And can you talk a little bit about why you decided to focus so much on that? And I asked that question because I really do think that, you know, Idaho journalists yourself, you know, as an author, I think we covered this very differently because there was no reason to make it sensational and ugly. And that felt like what was happening in a lot of the social media and some of the national media that were in town. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it makes sense. And that's what I discovered within a day of being up there was that the take on these crimes was from outsiders was different than the take on these crimes from insiders, meaning outsiders were running to the scene because they had been dispatched there in many cases. Insiders were running to the scene because their hearts had been broken. And, you know, you had East Coast and West Coast reporters showing up because it was an assignment. And sure, they're not insensitive people, but they have a job to do. And that job is to create headlines and get clicks in many instances. Not all of them are like that, but in many instances, that was their job. Also, you had YouTubers and podcasters who are making their livings now on clicks on their content as well. And you have amateur versions of professional journalists. Some are good and some are bad. But they're traveling the country chasing true crime stories. And what they bring with them is the need to survive. And with that need to survive is sometimes a breakdown in their ethical code. I understand that it's expensive to drive around the country and follow news stories on your own without a corporate dime giving you a per diem and things like that. But there were people there were TikTokers who showed up and did dances in front of the murder house. There were just an unusual amount of YouTubers and other cyber sleuths showing up without really any investigative pedigree, spreading false rumors, not because they necessarily wanted to do that, but because that's all they knew about the case. They didn't have that investigative acumen. And so they were just saying things that they thought in the spur of the moment. And because of that, the mass amount of mainstream media that was following this started also picking up on those things and saying, is it true that so-and-so did this? Let's investigate. And it was causing havoc for the Moscow Police Department. They had to answer thousands and thousands, or at least, I'm sorry, they had to siphon through thousands and thousands of tips. And if many of those tips are bogus, it makes their job really, really difficult. And that was apparent within the first day. There's a really interesting, unique line that one of the paparazzi that showed up said to me. He said, "I used to follow Justin Bieber 24/7. Now all I do is murders." And because that's where the money shots are for him, showing up at scenes. And he was actually a really great guy, lots of experience, a very big heart. But this was his job, to photograph crime scenes when he could. And, you know, it struck me immediately that there was an entire economy that had popped up around these murders. And that was no longer unique in our society. And that was sociologically, that said something to me that I wanted to explore in the book.
You know, I think you bring up a good point in the sense of, you know, so many people trying to cover this, amateur journalists or whatever we want to call them. I mean, there are podcasts out right now that have big companies behind them. I mean, big company names. If you listen to podcasts, and there's one in particular that I began listening to and I stopped because they were wrong. They were wrong. I mean, first off, they can't even pronounce certain towns and counties correctly, right? And sure. I know that might seem silly, but I'm like, if you aren't putting the time in to know how to pronounce even Latah County, I'm not going to listen to you. And because it goes back to this idea of, well, what else will you not get right when there are four young people who lost their lives? There is a person in custody who, you know, could go on trial, could be convicted. And yet there are still rumors circulating, right? So how did you address all of that in your research and in your book?
You mean, are you asking me how I figured out what was wrong and what was right before reporting on it?
Exactly.
If that's the case, then yeah, it was difficult. I mean, and plus I had a very quick timeline. This was a book that had to come out relatively quickly based on the publishing needs. And I worked on it for about 6 months and a little bit after that through some edits, but there was a lot of long days and long hours figuring out what was right and what wasn't. And it's not like having the benefit of writing about a cold case where other people have done the work for you. As you know, in the reporting business, it's like, you know, you're getting a lot of information in a really flash mob sort of style, like just thrown at you. That might be the wrong expression, but you have to siphon through it really, really quickly. And yeah, it was difficult. I spent 12, 14 hours days at my desk and saw nobody that I loved or cared about more or less for 6 months. I mean, that's how I did it. You know, you know, at some point, another writer friend of mine, and I were talking, and he said, you know, every day you grab your thermos and you go to work. It's no different than putting in 15, 16 hour line days on the assembly line. There's a lot to figure out in a short time to do it. There's a lot to get done, and you just do it. I mean, I know I'm sort of being vague about that, but a lot of it was just research stuff, right? You know, it's like saying, how did you learn medicine? Well, you spent 20 hours a day in the library. That's how. But that's how I did it. I learned my medicine, so to speak.
You know, I know that you're a private investigator here in Idaho as well. So I do want to ask you, do you believe that social media has changed the nature of criminal investigations like this one?
I definitely think it has. For starters, there's a lot of good that comes from the cyber sleuthing community. I mean, I'm a firm believer in crowdsourcing of information. Even the way they tracked some of the evidence on that knife sheet that we know now is left behind at the scene, the DNA evidence on that sheet, the way they were able to pinpoint the suspect, who Brian Koberger, who's their primary suspect, who's been arrested, or their only suspect, I should say, who's been arrested. Part of that was through genetic genealogy testing, and that is, in a sense, crowdsourcing of information. You know, millions of people submit their DNA to these databases, and then you can search through that DNA, right? Crowdsourcing is no different than Kickstarters, right? When you would fund artistic projects through one person giving a dollar, another giving six. I agree with the crowdsourcing theory of investigations in many ways. They can scour the internet for material in a way that, you know, 10 or 12 investigators cannot. When you have 600,000 people interested in this case and wanting to be a part of cracking it, that's great. On the other hand, it forced the hand of the Moscow Police Department to go public with information that they had, as much as they could have, gone public with, because they needed to dispel rumors that the cyber sleuthing community was starting, or false information that was spreading, which led to the verbal assaults and bullying of people named as perpetrators who weren't. Mm-hmm. A professor had to basically go underground with her family, afraid for her life. Other associates were named as killers and stuff. And it was just a very difficult time for a lot of the people up there who had nothing to do with this case. And I think that tension is not going away, that the next big case will have just as many people thrown at it. We've seen that in the Long Island murder stuff, as many cyber sleuths picking apart things. Every big case from now on, I think, is going to have millions of followers, because people want to be involved in a way that, to me, speaks to their loneliness and to their heartbreak at these types of things, and to the sadness that we all feel. We feel these things, and we hear these things in the news, and we feel them deeply, and we suffer from what we're feeling, and we don't know what to make of that. So when there's a community out there that we can be a part of in either finding new information to assist, or just communicating with one another, just like in the Facebook communities related to this case, a lot of it is not about the case anymore. It's just people posting, "Hey, how was your weekend?" People in this society experiencing the onslaught of media headlines about crime are feeling the need to connect. And because of that, these online cyber sleuthing communities are going to continue to grow. They're going to continue to put pressure on police when police have no answers. And that can be good, and that can be really, really bad, because police often have a lot of answers. They just can't tell you about it, because that's part of their job, is to keep it close to the chest until they solve the case. Mm-hmm. But it's going to get complicated.
Yeah. Before I let you go, Jay, no trial date has been set yet in this case. So what's next for you? I mean, are you going to continue to be, covering this and paying attention as this case continues?
Well, I'm definitely going to be paying attention as the case continues. If it's up in if the trial eventually happens up in Moscow or in that area, I won't be there on a daily basis or anything like that. But I will, follow the case. If the trial occurs in Boise, which some say it will have to, because of the quest for mm-hmm. for an impartial jury, will be a little bit mm-hmm. easier down in Ada County. Living in this state, that some people say no way they're going to keep it up in North Idaho, because that's where it happened, no matter what. And those people are tough up there, and they're going to fight to keep it there. That's possible. It might end up in Boise. If it ends up in Boise, I'll be there every day. Absolutely. I mean, I live about four. My office is about four blocks away from the courthouse. So there's no reason that I wouldn't be there every day. And in the meantime, I have other projects that I work on and my private investigative work, which the nature of it is that it's private. But I'll be doing that as well. But this case it means a lot more to me than just having a book published and walking away from it. I mean, I have an obligation at this point to the family members of the victims, to the victims themselves, to the community that I'm a part of, to the community up in North Idaho. This was not just something that, this was not a gig, you know, this was something that meant something to me. And of course I'll still be attached to this case now that the book is out for certain for the rest of my life. I mean, I still get messages on a weekly basis about the kill jar from people who were touched by that case. And I'm getting those messages now, starting this past week, for about While Idaho Slept, and I'm sure they will continue for years.
Thanks so much for listening to Idaho Matters. Boise State Public Radio and Idaho Matters are members of the NPR Network. It's an independent coalition of public media podcasters. You can find more shows in the network wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Gemma Gaudette. We'll see you tomorrow.
This is my voice. It can tell you a lot about me, and I'm not changing it for anyone. In NPR's Black Stories, Black Truths, you'll find a collection of NPR episodes centered on the Black experience. Search NPR Black Stories, Black Truths wherever you get podcasts.